As varied as our topography and soils, as rich as our resources, so varied and rich are the voices and stories of the folks around us. Come neighbor a bit with me, Sam Stroop. Grab a cup of coffee, pull up a comfy chair, let's get to talking. This is the second session talking with my friend John Thompson. If you missed the first, you'll probably want to catch it. Go to KPIP Facebook, click on to Sam Stroop, let's get to talking, and listen to John Thompson's From the Ozarks to Webster of Webster County to Lincoln University student. John and his wife Kim live on a small farm on the west edge of Old Franklin. John is retired from being a research worker at MU's Bradford Farm and the Agroforestry Center here at Franklin. He was raised on a dairy farm just east of Springfield. Tall and thin, John still puts in a long work day. He started lambing now, and though it's March 4th, tonight will be another cold one with a sub-zero wind chill. He and Kimberly will be up taking turns, checking the ewes in the barn every 2 hours to help dry off the lambs and getting them under heat lamps. They're a quarter of the way through lambing. All have had twins so far. That's an excellent 200% start on the lamb crop. But John's world has been greatly bigger than his sheep herd. That's what we did and will talk about. Let's get started. Well, John, I've always thought of you as being very bright, and I also think of you as being on the edge of cynical and negative.
I am that. I don't know about the bright.
I know about that. And I'm kind of wondering if some of that comes from being raised down in Webster County.
Oh, I don't know. That'd be like saying all Ozarkians are cynical and whatever. Yeah. And they're really not. They're just, you know, you got the full gamut there. Mm-hmm. Some people are just dumb enough they're happy all the time, I guess. I don't know. But
you and I both look at the future of agriculture and where it's headed, and it gives us pause, don't it? And you don't have this, but I have three sons, and do I try to push them into agriculture? Hell no.
Yeah. And that's part of the problem, too, because none of these country kids might be able to have the brains and the ability to farm. Nobody's telling them to do it because they don't want to give them bad advice, because who wants to work 20 hours a day and starve to death while you're doing it?
Yeah.
That's the reality of the situation.
You know, in 1990, I looked at the future of dairying, and I didn't see any. So we went into home delivering raw milk, and it worked. But I always told people, well, I'm not sure I'm even making minimum wage, but when you work 90 hours a week, it becomes an income.
Yeah.
But, you know, my sons didn't marry women that were up to that kind of a lifestyle.
Yes.
And I'm not dishing bad on my sons' daughter-in-laws. They're wonderful gals, but it's just not a world where we want to face that kind of a life anymore.
Most of these rural kids want to leave the rural areas behind as fast as they possibly can. I think the girls are probably worse than the boys. That's probably been going on for generations. They all have this idea if they can get to town, they'll all be movie stars or something. Yeah. I don't know what the deal is there, but looking for the good life.
It seems like Europe has tried, at least for a while, to be different and nurture small farms. I don't know if they're being successful at that either.
I think they are in some areas, and I think they aren't in other areas. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of a by-country thing, and what they're actually doing. Commodity production in places like Europe, you know, Germany grows no corn at all that I know of. I never saw any while I was there. There's probably some around somewhere there. Too cold and cloudy for that, and it's not great soybean country, so you know you I think the successful agriculture in, I know Holland has become pretty well all covered with glass.
Mm.
Huge greenhouses there. Mm. They're producing gobs. They say that's the agriculture of the future. They're producing lots of vegetables and fruits, I think, even under glass in Holland. They've kind of went that. They used to be the dairy area, but I think environmental laws and some things have cut into that. But I think as long as they find their niche, but in a lot of those countries, the government is more supportive of agriculture than it is here. Here, you know, we support agriculture, but not really, because you got subsidized agriculture, but then you don't have any land laws or anything like that. And heaven forbid if food prices would ever go up, American agriculture underwrites the American dream for everybody else is what it does. Mm-hmm. If you can keep food cheap, you don't have to pay high wages to people. Mm-hmm. And everybody's happy if they can eat for free.
Yeah.
That's what they would really like. All my life I've heard people complain, food's too high, groceries are too high, you know. And I think, well, if you gave it to them, they'd want you to deliver it, probably, because the necessities like that, people just don't want to. If you don't have to pay anything to eat, it leaves you more money for bigger cars and color TVs.
It was fun to me. Fun? No. Interesting. Interesting watching the NAFTA talks and the attack on Canada for having a supportive system for small and average-sized dairies, and because they have a quota system up there, and the yelling and screaming from Americans saying, we want to dump our cheap milk on you in Canada. Screw your dairymen. Let them fall apart and disintegrate. We want your market.
That's right.
And they never caved to that. You know, they talk like, yeah, we made concessions and everything's fine, but I get the impression they did not cave, and they are keeping intact their quota system so that they can continue to have large numbers of dairies up there.
Seems like the only way we can have a foreign market's either threaten or blackmail somebody.
Mm. Mm.
I think the only real beef markets we have is Korea and Japan, and the only reason we have them is because we threaten them.
Huh.
I know that's the case with Korea. They would probably, both those countries would buy all their beef from Australia.
Huh.
If it wasn't for us threatening them to buy that. And I remember the Koreans riot.
What do you mean by the threatened part?
Political.
Okay.
We provide all of the for a good part of the defense for both of them and other things, and we have to force, like rice in Japan was super protected. They wouldn't allow any imports at all because it was a traditional thing, and they kept the rice prices real high, and it was nobility pretty well that grew the rice in Japan. And I think we finally forced that market open after trying and trying for years, because they wouldn't allow any cheap rice to come in there. The Koreans rioted here a few years ago about the mad cow disease, American beef,
mm-hmm.
and we finally had to guarantee them that the beef would be no spinal cord,
right,
and all under a certain age. And I think about the second shipment they got was full of spinal cord.
I just today got I'm not sure why I even get it. It's from the National Farmers Organization, and every month I get a little newsletter from them. And I think way back when my dad may have signed me up as a lifetime member or something, and that's why I started getting this newsletter again. But it was an interesting how it shows how government policy really could change things. So the NFL was proposing not a quota system on the United States dairies, but instead said, let's go with $4 a hundredweight, better milk price for any dairy farm that ships less than 1 million pounds of milk a month. So I did the math on it, and that would mean dairies that are 300 to 500 cows. So those are still big dairies.
Yeah.
But right now what we have is 3,000 to 5,000 cow herds.
Yeah, I know.
Run by who knows who is doing that. I'm not sure. But a simple policy, you know, one way or another, if we're going to keep milk in the United States, we're going to have to do something about prices or there will be absolutely no milkers left.
Yeah.
And so here is a simple, you know, I don't know all the economics on it, but it kind of made sense and it kind of pictured how, you know, you can play a few little games that would really change the picture on things. But it won't happen.
Yes, in the United States, you can't get anything that makes sense done because too many oxen are going to get gored, and you've got too many special interests that are jumping up, you know, and they'll either weight so many nonsense things in on the bill too, or change it to benefit somebody else to where it's meaningless anyway. Mm-hmm. If you look at a country like New Zealand, has kind of been. New Zealand has always been an export market, and mostly agricultural, and they've done mostly cheese and milk, and wool and mutton, lamb, and I guess some beef, probably. They're way down there, way off from anybody, and they do that. They don't have near the resources that we have here. You know, the cropland, that's mostly grazing country. That's why they're such an authority on grazing systems. Mm-hmm. And they've done all of that and been fairly prosperous, I guess, all these years. And then here, you know, part of our problem is too much. We've always had too much land that could be plowed and planted. And agriculture in the United States has always suffered more from overproduction than anything else. That's always been our big problem. Mm-hmm. And so you got this deal where the only way that people can make a living is constantly increasing their production, but at the same time you're doing that, you're cutting your own throat.
An interesting thing going on in New Zealand now, I don't know if you've probably followed it, but maybe not, is, you know, they're because they're exporting, they didn't want just export water, which is milk. So so they had concentrated on Jerseys and Jersey cross animals, which is less water and more protein and
fat,
right? Yeah. So they, you know, they were had more bang for their buck. Well, then the Chinese had this problem with they were adding something to the formula of children. It was really toxic, disastrous stuff. This was a few years back, and the Chinese just went in an uproar over, we are not providing our people with safe food. And so they all started looking at, whoa, what do we really want in our formula and milk for our kids? And they started looking at the superiority of Jersey and Jersey cross milk. And some gene, I think they call A2 milk, which I don't understand at all.
I've read a little bit about that, and I don't understand it, and I'm not convinced that it's actually
true. I'm not either, but the Chinese are.
Yeah, yeah.
And so now they are clamoring for New Zealand formula milk for their children.
it may not be just the breed of cattle, but also the pasturage.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
What animals eat has an effect on what they produce,
too. So they don't want America's Holstein milk. They want New Zealand's
Jersey
cross milk.
Well, you see, they're cutting out a niche in a specialty like that. Yeah, that's the only hope that small farmers have in the United States these days, and I've known that since in the 1970s. If you're any way small at all, you've got to be a niche farmer.
Yeah.
And some of those niche farmers can do quite well, but probably for every one that does quite well, there's probably 50 that start something and go down the drain for various reasons. Either it was the wrong niche or it all died out. You know, ostriches look good to a few people there for a while.
Yeah. You came to work here at New Franklin at the, what do they call the experimental station here?
It's agroforestry. I don't know the whole title. Let me think of what it is. Used to be the horticulture farm, but agroforestry took it over back in the early 90s.
You retired from it. How many years did you work here?
For agroforestry, I think I probably worked from 2002 till 2012 or 13, somewhere along
the way. Okay, so a good 10 or 11 years. Yeah. Did you get sent up here, or did you ask to get the job here?
Actually, when I had to have surgery on my neck, and I quit working with the entomology people, and I wasn't working with the university at all.
Okay.
I was unemployed. And I wasn't sure that I'd ever work anywhere again because I was getting old, and I wasn't sure. I was lucky. My surgery turned out real good on my neck, and I was good as new. But I wasn't sure that anybody would hire me, but in some areas I had a pretty good reputation, I guess, and they hired me there, and I finished up here doing mostly grass work.
Okay.
They do tree and other stuff up here, but I done a little bit of everything up there, but my main thing was to work with worm season grasses.
Okay. Which worm season grasses were you working with?
Big blue stems, switchgrass, some eastern gamma grass.
Now, this had already been going on for a while with the worm season grasses, so what new things were you exploring with them?
Shade,
okay.
That's how it worked in with the trees.
Okay.
See how shade tolerant different ones were. We grew them under shade cloth.
Okay.
And then later on out under real trees. That worm season grass thing was about the only thing that was going on in the agronomy department at the University of Missouri when I went there in the early 90s, because they couldn't get it. It was the only thing that was funded. And that came about because the CRP, people was having them all put worm season grasses in. The conservation department's always pushed that, so there was everybody. Worm season grass was the answer to everybody's problem. And there wasn't any money to do research with for other things, so the MU, the professors, were getting all of their money from the conservation department and from the NRCS to do worm season grass stuff.
Okay.
So everybody was doing something with worm season grass when I first went to MU. But I worked with worm season native legumes, the legume complement and that, so I was off there by myself doing something unique. A lot of those legumes I worked with is the native natural complement, legume complement to those. Later on, the NRCS mandated they plant those native legumes in with the CRP worm season grasses.
Tell me a little more about the worm, the natural, the native legumes, what some of the names are. Do we see them growing in the roadsides naturally around us?
Yes, you sure do. Most people don't know what they're looking at when they see them, but that's one of the few places you actually see them is in the roadside, because one of their great weaknesses and why you don't see them is because they won't stand up to grazing or mowing.
Oh, okay.
That kills them out, so they mostly wherever they get grazed, they've died out. And there are several of them that are native perennial Lespedezas. There's Lespedeza capitata, Lespedeza virginica, Lespedeza stuvii, and Lespedeza herda. And there's some others that are smaller than that. And then there's, I think, probably 25 species of Desmodium that grows in Missouri, some more common than others. Some of it's a wooded shade area that it goes all the environments. Desmodium illinoisensis is a tall grass prairie.
So then they can be successfully planted and managed as a pasture crop if they're rotated?
They don't even stand up well under that, because usually the livestock will sort them out and eat them before they will the warm season grass.
And so then how can you manage for them?
Well, just kind of in a prairie setting where it's not really grazed hardly any at all, and they're not, most of them aren't real good forage either.
Okay.
They tend to be stemmy. Some of them have some fair potential for forage if they had any persistence.
So what I'm hearing is you researched them, but they really, it's mainly a wildlife thing.
Wildlife and the native legume complement for nitrogen in things.
Okay.
Spores them ever replacing any of the introduced legumes for forages, that would be a pie in the sky thing.
Okay.
Never work out. Right?
Yeah.
Some of them have some pretty good forage quality. One of the Desmodiums paniculatum is one of the better Desmodiums for that we tested. And there's one little Lespediza that's just outstanding for forage quality, but you'd never be able to produce seed commercially off of it because it's indeterminate.
Hmm.
It has blooms and seeds at different stages all the time.
Huh.
All you got to do is touch one of those single pod seeds when it's ripe and it falls off, so you'd never be able to grow seed.
Interesting.
I never was able to collect enough seed to even grow a few plants for that because you got to catch it just right and just get like one seed off each plant.
Hmm.
But they have good forage quality. Hmm.
As I hear you talking about these plants, I hear behind you that Jamaican plant scientist teacher that's so amazed your life.
Well, there's, besides the Desmodiums and the Lespedizas, there's Illinois' bundle flower. A lot of people are familiar with that alongside the roads. It's Mimosidae. It's got real fine leaves. It gets tall.
Mm-hmm.
And it has mimosa-type bloom on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the pods are in like a cluster.
Yeah.
It's a tall grass prairie thing.
Is the flower yellow?
No, it's kind of white.
All right.
And then there's some little offbeat type native legumes like goat's root. That's Tephrosia. Yeah.
So which warm season grass did you find works best under trees that are being raised?
Oh, probably big blue stem.
It can handle the shade.
Up to a point.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them, there's a lot of diversity even within those species.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking at some of that diversity. Switchgrass and big blue stem probably pretty close in their tolerance, but I think the big blue stem probably just a little bit better. Didn't work enough with Eastern Gamma to really know, but I have seen Eastern Gamma out in some woods. It usually grows in low swampy spots, but I have seen some out down by Ha Ha Tonka one time down there on a tour. I seen some right out in some thickets, but I don't know how well it done.
Yeah.
We didn't really work that much with Eastern Gamma grass.
Maybe you don't know about this, but with your cool season grasses, somebody recently said, the only lawn grass I can get to grow under my trees is bluegrass. And is that pretty shade tolerant compared to some others?
It is. And bluegrass and orchard grass are probably the most shade tolerant grasses we've got. Okay. And the orchard grass got its name for that.
Mm-hmm.
They're both introduced. Mm-hmm. Well, bluegrass, there's some debate about that.
Okay.
Whether it was introduced or not. One time it was said to be introduced, but there's some other people now that think that it might be endemic here. But there's a whole bunch of different kinds of bluegrass, too. Some of it was native.
So you came here to work with warm season grasses under shade. You said you did a little bit of everything here.
Oh, yeah.
So you got quite involved with the agroforestry side of it, too, then.
Oh, I helped those guys prune and pick up chestnuts and things like that.
Yeah.
But, what most of us got an education for, work at the Hort Farm Forest to mow grass to make it look like a golf course and build fence.
Huh. Yeah.
You have to have a graduate degree to do that, you know.
Is this station, and maybe you don't want to get into this, is it being helpful to the state of Missouri? Are there people that are really getting some good information out of it, or is that a little debatable?
I'm probably the wrong person to ask about that, because I do have some biases there, but the nut people are probably getting some pretty good stuff out of it.
Well, that's good to hear.
Otherwise, I suspect it's...
And the nut people are pecans.
Pecans, chestnuts, and black walnuts.
Okay. Huh.
They've had a black walnut breeder up here that's done some really neat stuff.
And all three of those now, well, we know the pecans are very commercial.
Yeah.
And you can make a living with pecans. What about the walnuts and the chestnuts? Are they getting that direction?
Well, walnuts have been a commercial crop in Missouri for years and years. And most of them are picked up by women and kids out of cow pastures.
Right.
Whether they'll ever be something other than a hobby for like orchard plantations, mm-hmm. black walnuts and them be profitable unless you work grazing or something in with it. A lot of those people don't want to.
Okay.
I'm not so certain that that'd ever work out.
Right. What about chestnuts?
The chestnuts, it's still kind of up in the air. There's a lot of people interested in chestnuts and planting them now, but that's kind of a niche crop, too.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody likes chestnuts. Yeah. Most of the market around here for chestnuts, the Chinese students at MU.
What information has come out of here that maybe has helped the pecan growers?
Cultivars.
Okay.
These plots right down here alongside the road, those are cultivar trials, and that's been the most important thing they've done. They've got almost all of the northern cultivars of pecans growing down there, and they rate them for production and disease resistance and
mm-hmm.
nut shape and all of hullability and all.
So they're finding the superior lines for the pecan growers.
Pretty well already have, I think.
Okay, so then how has that information gotten out to the pecan growers, or
have they
come to you all for it?
They have, I won't say seminars, but it's,
okay.
They have days up here when they have all these growers that are interested mm-hmm. come up here and do things, the chestnut people, the walnut people, and the pecan people, and that's how a lot of that gets transferred.
Okay.
But also through agroforestry publications.
All right.
And probably extension, too.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, the information's out there. If you
Does this place become a source for the people to come to get what they want to, what am I trying to say?
Yes, and yeah.
Craft and start trees?
Signwood.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for.
That's kind of yes and no. I think not everybody can come and do that.
Okay.
But I know they have packaged and... Mm-hmm. and sent signwood out to other researchers as well as some nursery people.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, if the general public went through the right procedures and everything, they could probably get some signwood too there.
Well, that's interesting, and I'm glad to hear all that. And when you're as close to a situation as you were, then it's easy to see negatives.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's important to say, these are some good things going on.
Yeah.
It's good hearing all that. So thank you on that. Tell me about your farm. When did you find this place?
This?
Yeah.
Oh, in March of 1999,
okay.
I was renting a house in Ashland. Had planned on being there for 2 years to get a graduate degree and ended up living there 7. Took me that long to get my graduate degree, which it should not have. And they kept raising the rent and whatever, and I had always thought, well, you know, as soon as I get a job with the extension, I'm going to be moving somewhere else in Missouri, so I ain't going to get too wild. And then I finally figured out that probably wasn't going to happen. And so I was kind of looking around a little bit, and I always liked this side of Columbia a lot better than the other areas. And I figured I'd probably still be working at the university. And we looked around a little bit, and I stopped over here at the real estate place in Boonville, Quinlan's. I'd seen a house in their paper that I was interested in. And when I stopped over there, I was talking to the guy, and he said, oh, no, you probably don't want that house. You can't heat that thing. He said, this is probably what you want over here. And I said, where's that? And he said, over there by Old Franklin. And I said, well, I just came from over there. I'd been up here at work. And we came over here, and I said, that's where I work, you know. And so I was interested, and the price was right, and it was kind of run down shape, But I told everybody, I said, well, if it wasn't in bad shape, I'd never be able to afford it. But so I've been working on it ever since. I don't know which was the smartest to do.
You got 15, 20 acres here?
Seven and a half.
Seven and a half. Okay. Yeah. Well, I see it as being an outstretch of what your life has been all about. You know, you've got a nice flock of sheep. Get to play in the dirt, planting different things for your sheep to eat. And
wonder at times when you get up at midnight and it's 1 degree out to go out to see if you're having lambs, wondering, you know, why am I doing this? Because I'm not really, when I figure everything, making any money off of this. And here I go through this every spring, you know, worry about this, worry about that.
Right.
And you think, you know, some people are just born stupid. That's all there is to it. Suckers for abuse.
Well, the nice thing about the nasty weather is we take time, my wife and I, to sit and talk a little more than we do a lot of the rest of the year.
That's probably true.
On several occasions we've asked ourselves, you know, we could have cashed in, bought a little house in town, just had a little tiny lawn to mow, and we could, you know, do some traveling and be obnoxious with our children, go around and spend a couple weeks of time with them. And her comment always is, hell no, I want to work till the day I die. So here we are.
When I was in undergraduate school and lived in Jefferson City, that's before Kim and I got married, if it hadn't been for the farms down there at Lincoln University, I used to spend all my time down there.
Huh.
I would have went crazy because I had a little house rented in town there. Mm-hmm. And I have to have the abuse, so I was always down there at that farm all hours of the night and stuff, delivering lambs and stuff in zero weather.
Yeah.
And then when I lived in Ashland, I always refer to those times as during the confinement.
Yeah.
Because it felt kind of like being in prison. I took up wood carving. I built a thresh machine out in the backyard. I did all kinds of things because, you know, I couldn't stand it. Years ago, back in the 70s, I had a fairly long-term girlfriend. And she told me one time, she said, you know, you're a masochist. said, you're into self-abuse. And she was serious. And I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, you're always out here doing putting up hay and doing all this stupid stuff. You know, you work till in the night, every night and everything, and it don't make you a dime. you're just crazy. And she's probably right. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have it all figured out, but I'm of the same ilk as you. And I think that's why I have very close friendships over among the Amish, because when I go over there, it's like looking in the mirror, seeing these people are just working their butts into the ground. But to me, I'm never happier than when I'm working with other men, working hard alongside of them. Mm-hmm. And so I go over there fully knowing that they're going to be doing some crappy jobs, and I can shoulder up with them, and we're going to have a good time sweating together.
Yeah. Just think what an awful shape the world would be in, though, if it wasn't for us fools that were stupid enough to like to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
My son is, my youngest one is a roofer in the summer. He's got a college degree, but he's roofing, and now it's too cold to roof, so he's been working for Henge's tree service. And his big excitement is, Dad, they're bringing up some Mexican workers next week, and I know they're going to be fabulous workers, and it's going to be such a privilege working with them compared to the guys they keep dumping on me that last for 1 week and they're gone.
You know, I'm glad to hear somebody's got an attitude like that, because he probably right. And, you know, it's not politically right to have that kind of attitude. You're not supposed to say bad things about your fellow Americans and build up an immigrant at all. I've seen some of those Mexicans work around. All the nurseries and dairies and everything are run by them, and when they shut off the supply,
we're in trouble.
Already I've read things in the papers where these farmers, like California, those big fruit and vegetable farmers and dairy farmers out there, they're totally dependent on that.
I heard one guy interviewed, I think he raised salary, and said, I'm losing all my workers. They're scared to death. They're heading back home. You know what this means? I'm going to have to move my farm to Mexico.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, is that the solution we're after in America?
I've done a lot of work on the Edwards Plateau down there, actually with Texas A&M people training with them down there in the Angora goat and Rambouillet sheep country.
Yeah.
And big ranches. To be viable, you got to have 40 sections.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those ranches we were out on were like 150, 200 sections. That's almost unimaginable.
Mm.
Every one of them got Mexican labor there, and they like them. They've been there for generations, you know.
Yeah.
They're all interdigitated and stuff. You say anything bad about those Mexican laborers down there, you probably have to fight those ranchers.
Yeah.
They couldn't run those ranches without them. And then you hear all this, oh, yeah, they're all cutthroats and this and that and the other. I take two or three newspapers, and I see a lot of bad dudes in those newspapers, and very few of them are Hispanic.
Yeah.
We do a good job of raising the homegrown ourselves.
Well, I'm afraid I'm going to talk you into having no voice left. But I really appreciate your taking the time.
Well, I get to rattling along. I'm a pretty good liar most of the time. I've got to that point in life where about the only thing that works on me is my mouth.
Yeah. Well, again, thanks for this time together.
Well, hopefully that done you some good, and hopefully it won't get us all burned out.
The vast experiences and knowledges of my fellow Howard Countyans amazes me. John Thompson is another example of that. I challenge you to ask your neighbors for a peek into their world. You'll learn so much from them and be richer for it. So till next time.